From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Harlem is going through a revitalization, some say a second Harlem Renaissance. Housing prices are up, crime is down, and development is everywhere. Some preservationists worry that all the progress is destroying some of Harlem's greatest treasures, and they're asking whose vision of Harlem will triumph. NPR's Margot Adler has more.
Walking across 125th Street in the center of Harlem, you can't help noticing the big stores everywhere. If it weren't for the Senegalese hair braiders sitting on the sidewalk in vibrant colored dresses and incense sellers everywhere, you might be in Middle America. There's McDonald's, Starbucks, Marshall's, Old Navy, the Disney Store. Nellie Hester Bailey of the Harlem Tenants Council looks onto 125th Street from her office and says if tourists find the same bland strip mall here that they have at home,
what is the incentive for tourists to come to Harlem?
But tourists are coming to Harlem for its history, its churches, and its architecture. And upwardly mobile African Americans are moving in or back. 5 years ago, a Harlem brownstone going for $1 million for $2 million was unheard of, not now. As developers come in and prices for houses and office space go up, preservationists have to worry about historic buildings that don't pay their way. Cathedral bells call out the noon hour at St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue. 24 demonstrators chant and carry signs, protesting the closing of their Harlem Catholic Church, St. Thomas the Apostle, considered a neo-Gothic jewel. Eric Tate is a parishioner.
For them to close it is a crime. It's a sacrilege.
They need money to keep it open, so they put a padlock on it, and we need that padlock up.
The loudest chants come from Michael Henry Adams, who has made the preservation of Harlem his personal mission. Adams is guest curator of an exhibition on Harlem currently at the Museum of the City of New York. His latest book is Style and Grace, African Americans at Home. When I meet Adams, he's wearing a straw boater hat, a cream-colored jacket, a lavender shirt, and a multicolored striped tie. Take a Harlem walking tour with Adams, and he can show you the place where Ralph Ellison lived, or Groucho Marx, or where Malcolm X had an office. He can take you back to the Harlem Renaissance, to a time many people have forgotten.
Here was the epicenter of the world, right here in Harlem, at the end of the 1920s. And Lincoln Kirsten, the ballet impresario, he said, you know, it wasn't the angry place that it later came to be. For us, it was just another arrondissement of Paris.
When pointing out historically significant buildings, Adams always has the same refrain. There are about 12,000 buildings protected by landmarking in Manhattan, and only 10% are north of 96th Street.
Most of what you look at any given time when you're in a place like Harlem is not protected.
He argues that buildings of a similar historical worth are landmarked without question in Greenwich Village or Soho. Adams' dreams for Harlem's restoration are bold and glorious. For example, why not renovate the Hotel Teresa where Fidel Castro stayed?
Why just have another Days Inn in Harlem? Wouldn't it be exciting for people to be able to stay in the same room that Fidel Castro received Khrushchev?
Or the room in which Joe Louis stayed, the first black to integrate the hotel? Adams' uncompromising stance in favor of landmarking has put him at odds with many Harlem developers and even some of Harlem's cultural leaders.
Ultimately in America, whatever else you have to say about things, somebody's got to pay.
That's Howard Dodson, the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture. The Schomburg Center wanted to demolish a historic Harlem building to expand its facility. When the building was landmarked, the project ended.
It was probably a good thing from a historic perspective to have the building landmarked. From a development perspective, that's another question. The growth and development of some always comes at the cost of some others.
One particular project Adams opposes is an international house of pancakes and school that will be built on the site of Small's Paradise, one of the only African-American-owned nightclubs during the Harlem Renaissance. The facade will remain. Adams believes the project is a travesty. Dodson says people tried every scenario possible, and preserving Small's was not economically viable.
Do you preserve Small's and have it sit there doing nothing? Or do you look for ways of turning it into an economically viable resource for the community? Has that done violence to the history of Smalls? Probably in some respect. But what alternatives do you have?
Adams replies that if it were a historic theater or nightclub or hotel in Soho, a will and a way would have been found. Adams is not opposed to business. He takes me to Seti Pani, an Italian coffee shop with every gourmet coffee choice and pastry delicacy one might get in Greenwich Village. He says it's a departure for Harlem.
So many owners have had the attitude, well, the people here are stuck, so anything that we offer them will be good enough. And now we don't have to put up with that anymore.
We go in.
Good morning. May I have an iced cappuccino with hazelnut, please?
But so far, the Harlem Settipani is not doing as well as the company's cafes in Westchester. Some of the biggest success stories in preservation here are the attempts by individuals to restore Harlem's extraordinary brownstones. One of the most beautifully preserved sections of Harlem is a two-block area known as Stryver's Row. There are brownstones by three architects, the most famous, Stanford White. Don Cogsville, an investment banker and formerly the president of the Harlem Urban Development Corporation, is walking out of his brownstone on Stryver's Row when he sees Adams, and he invites us into his newly renovated home.
We're just now getting back into the house. We have a little baby that was just born on Saturday.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We bought it from the first black family to move on to Stryver's Row, the Carter family, Dr. Carter.
Cogsville says he grew up in Harlem.
I think we're sort of exemplifying, to some extent, a movement of people like us trying to get back and really sort of sink roots and not just live here and sort of suck the community dry, but really come back and hopefully want to send our kids to school here and do things that are positive.
As little as 15 years ago, 60% of the buildings in Harlem were owned by the city, and African Americans only owned 6% of the properties. While statistics are hard to come by, everyone agrees black ownership is on the rise, and not all preservationists in Harlem are wealthy. Josephine Jones lives on 122nd Street. She is 83 years old, and she has been slowly renovating a brownstone she bought over 20 years ago for $15,000. It's a dream house, she says. Ever since, as a child, living in a shack in South Carolina, she played in a vacant mansion belonging to white owners.
It had stained glasses like this. The wainscoting was all around. I was 8 years old. I said, you know, I'm going to work, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to buy me this house. I want this house so we can have this stained glass and everything.
She's been doing bits of renovation ever since.
And I'm not going to give it up, because I think the whole area should be saved.
We're going to get it done.
We're going to get it done. I want the historic lights back here, and it can be done. We need to wake up. Wake up the Harlem.
Perhaps the fight between preservationists and developers in Harlem, the tug and pull between old and new, is not so different from other American communities. But what's noticeable about Harlem is how many vibrant people, rich and poor, are bringing new life to this community. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.